A Matter of Luck. A program dedicated to the greatest inventor and scientific discoverer the world has known, Lady Luck. And bringing you in one complete 30-minute presentation, two authentic and true stories of remarkable scientific achievement. Tonight, we tell you of Thomas Alva Edison and Alessandro Volta, and how each became famous through a matter of luck. Thomas Alva Edison and a Matter of Luck. The name of Thomas Alva Edison will go down in history as that of a man who had possibly the most inventive mind of the 19th century. A man whose industry and talents were sufficient to solve almost any problem put to him. And yet, the invention for which he is most famous owes its birth to a matter of luck. From his earliest years, Edison had shown more than ordinary intelligence, not so much in the fields of science and invention as in business. But while he was still a youth, a chance accident altered the course of his life. He lived with his parents at Port Huron in Michigan, not far from Detroit, and one day he was walking near the train tracks.
What does that little girl think she's doing?
Hey, little girl, keep away from the line, there's a train coming. Hey, keep away, hey there. But get away, you'll be run over. Look out for the train! Look out!
Whew, that was close. Too close for me. Young lady, you are the luckiest and the silliest girl in Michigan. Now, what's your name, eh? Oh, you won't talk, eh? Well, it doesn't matter. I know you. You're the station master's little daughter. Now, come along. I'm going to take you home.
Man, I'll never be able to thank you enough. If there's ever anything I can do to repay you for saving my daughter's life...
Well, sir, there is one thing you could do.
Well, speak up, then. Anything that's in my power...
Well, I've always wanted to see how the railway telegraph system works. You see, I'm rather interested in that kind of thing.
You are, eh? Well, just you come round to the station tomorrow and I'll show you all you'll ever want to know about it. Why, if you're that keen, I might even get you a job as an operator.
Would you do that, sir? Would you really?
Well, just you come round in the morning and we'll see.
And so Thomas Edison started work with the Grand Trunk Railroad as a telegraph operator. But the novelty of night duty soon wore off, and for the first time in his life, Edison turned to inventing. The railroad company had a rule that night operators were required to give a prescribed Morse signal every hour to indicate that they were awake. But Edison thought differently.
Oh, I'm darned if I'm going to stay awake all night for two or three messages that will wake me up when they come through anyway. Oh, let me think. Yes, that'll do it. That'll send the hourly signal through. Yes, that'll do it perfectly.
Edison built his first gadget, a contrivance that worked from the station clock and sent the necessary signal for him. But one night...
Hey there! You in there! Wake up! Wake up!
All right. All right, I'm coming. What's the matter?
You're supposed to stay awake on the job. The company doesn't pay you to sleep all night. If it wasn't that I got you the job... Uh-huh, what's this? Well, what do you know? Fix the clock and a couple of magnets to send your signal in for you, eh? Very clever.
Well, I didn't think it'd do any harm. I always wake up for signals, you know that.
If you're clever enough to think up a thing like this, you're wasting your time working here. Yes, sir. So, from now on, you don't. Get me?
Edison was soon looking for other worlds to conquer. He traveled about the United States studying and gaining invaluable experience, and by 1869, when he was 22, he was on the threshold of his career. He arrived in New York when that city was in the throes of a wild speculation in gold. 600 Wall Street brokers received their market prices by wire from the Gold Reporting Company. At the height of one day's furious trading, the ticker machines broke down at the company's headquarters, and by the merest chance, young Edison was nearby. He knew how the machines worked, and he seized the opportunity.
Where will I find the president of this company?
In the door there, but he's too busy to see anyone now.
He'll see me. I can fix the ticker machines.
Dr. Laws,
can you spare me a minute, sir?
Confound it, no. Get out of my way. Laker. Laker, you fool. Can't you get the engineers here?
But, Dr. Laws, you don't want the engineers. You want me.
So I don't, eh? 600 brokers on my neck. The market crashing, my machine's not operating, and I have to listen to you. Get out! I'm ruined.
Well, just a minute, sir. I can fix your machine.
I said get out.
All right, if you want to be ruined.
Hey, just a minute. Can you really fix these things?
Yes, sir. I can.
Then get your coat off and start work. But I warn you, if you're fooling, I'll have you thrown in the Hudson River. And these infernal ticker machines after you.
Thomas Edison repaired the machines and averted a stock market debacle, and his fortune was made. We see him next set up in a workshop and laboratory in New Jersey with a staff of mechanics and technicians whose task was to improve telegraphy and communications generally. One invention after another flowed from his fertile brain. Here's where the brilliant inspirations and the working models were made by the chief of his mechanics, a Swiss named Krusi. Then came a demand for a machine to record telegrams and retransmit them at three times the speed. And from this sprang Edison's most famous invention. The machine was soon designed, and Edison explained to Krusi, the mechanic, who was to build the first working model.
Now, see here, Krusi. I've thought it all out, and here's the first rough drawings of it.
The recorder and transmitter.
Yes. Now, this is how it works. A needle will press on this circular disc of wax board as it revolves at a certain speed.
Yeah.
Say, 50 revolutions a minute.
Yeah.
You see?
Yeah, I see.
As the message comes in over the wire, the needle will press down. Mm. A short press for a dot, a long press for a dash.
Yeah.
Thus scratching an impression of the dots and dashes in the wax on the disc.
That's very good, Mr. Edison. Very good.
And now, to transmit at a higher speed than we received, we simply let the pressed disc rotate faster under another needle. This needle follows the dots and dashes and will send out the message almost as fast as we like.
Yeah, I see that. Very good. You want me to work on it now?
Yeah, right away.
Soon the recorder was built, but certain modifications were necessary. One night, Edison was asleep in the workshop after a hard day, with Krusi working on the machine in another room, when an extraordinary occurrence took place.
Mr. Edison. Wake up, Mr. Edison. Wake up.
What is it?
Wake up and come quickly. Something I do not understand. Quickly.
What are you talking about?
The recording machine. It makes noises. It makes noises like a woman. It screams.
You've gone mad.
Come, see for yourself if I am mad. It is the machine that has gone mad. The recording machine.
Oh, all right. But I wish you'd left me asleep.
Now then, Mr. Edison, I started going, yes?
Yes, turn it on. Turn it off? I can't stand that noise.
Mayo, what manner of machine have we made?
I don't know, Crucy. It's darned interesting. Now, let's have a look. First of all, the governor that controls the speed of the disk isn't working. So it runs at about 10 times too fast. Yeah, that's the first thing.
But what is it that makes the noise?
Well, this disk has been impressed with dots and dashes. And the needle runs over them at a very high speed.
Yeah.
The needle is agitated violently hundreds of times a second, and the noise results. Crucy, this gives me an idea.
Thomas Edison did not sleep that night, for the stroke of luck in the faulty recorder had shown him how to make a device such as the world had never seen. He sat until dawn with drawing board and pencils, and when the mechanic Crucy reported for work, the design was ready.
About this idea of yours last night.
Now sit down and listen, Crucy. This new machine is going to set the world by the ears. Now, first of all, here's what you do. You take a brass cylinder about 8 inches long and 3 in diameter.
Yeah?
The exact size doesn't matter. Mm. And cut a narrow spiral groove in it from one end to another.
Like the thread of a screw?
Yes, but shallower and finer. Say, 50 to the inch.
Yeah?
Then mount it on an axle that can be turned by a crank handle. Got that?
Yeah, I have got it, but...
Then build this membrane and needle attachment I've drawn here, just as you see it in the drawing.
Yeah, but... What is this thing? What does it do?
I'll tell you all that in good time.
Soon, the apparatus was built and ready. And Edison gathered what he hoped were to be the first people in the world to hear his remarkable demonstration. Engineers and staff gathered round, none with the slightest inkling of what they were about to witness.
You will all have to be perfectly quiet, gentlemen. Not a sound, please. Crucy, turn the crank slowly.
Yeah.
I shall speak into this tin horn while Crucy cranks. Well, here we go. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went... The lamb was sure to go. Now hold your breaths, everyone. Crucy, put the needle back to the start and turn again at the same speed.
Yeah.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went... The lamb was sure to go.
Oh, wow.
Yep. But upon my soul, the thing talked. I heard it.
That, gentlemen, was an instrument I have decided to call the phonograph, meaning the writing of the voice. And I can tell you that never in my whole life have I experienced such a thrill. I have registered the human voice and reproduced it for the first time in history.
And so, a few days before Christmas of 1876, the phonograph was born. The instrument that has brought the world's music and the voices of the world's artists to millions of people in every country on earth. But until Thomas Edison's telegraph recording machine made its scratchy wailing through chance and a fault in its mechanism, the idea of the phonograph had never entered his head, and possibly never would have. So it is true to say that the invention of the phonograph and the gramophones and radiograms that derive from it was not a matter of intent. No, indeed, it was merely a matter of luck.
In just 1 minute, we shall tell you another fascinating true story, that of Alessandro Volta. At the moment, we pause for a word from our announcer.
Back now to our narrator and cast for the second unusual but true story in our program, A Matter of Luck. Alessandro Volta and A Matter of Luck. One evening in 1790, a professor of medicine was lecturing to his pupils in his home at Bologna in Italy. On this occasion, which was to be of such importance in the history of natural science, the professor and his listeners were in the chief room of the house, which, in accordance with the custom of the day, was drawing room, lecture room, bedroom, and kitchen in one. So that while the professor lectured on one side, his good wife prepared the evening meal on the other. His name was Aloisio Galvani, and on this particular evening, his wife was skinning frogs for supper with the steel scalpel he normally used for dissections and surgery. Unhygienic, but true.
Oh, my poor Aloisio. You love your frog's legs for supper, but the work you make for me... Donna Maria, here is a fat one. Come, little fat frog, off with your skin. So, we peel a little here and a little there. Ow! Oh!
What is it, Signora? You have cut yourself with a scalpel, yes?
Aloisio, I have been skinning a live frog.
A live one? Oh, so the butcher boy plays a little joke, eh? He sells us a live frog among the dead ones, the better to scare the sonora. Ha! Now, silence, silence! This is no laughing matter, gentlemen. Now, my dear, which is the live frog?
This one that is half-skinned.
But, my dear, no frog could be deader. See?
It was alive a minute ago. It nearly jumped off the platter.
My dear, you must be mistaken. This frog is not only dead, but has been for some time. Here, try it for yourself.
I don't care, Aloisio. I don't care what it smells like. It jumped and it twisted. I saw it.
Show me. Let me see it move a muscle.
But now it will not move. It won't move at all. But, Aloisio, I swear by all the saints it did. Twice before.
Show me exactly what you did before. Exactly.
Well, I laid it on the plate. Thus, and placed the scalpel thus, and skinned it. There, see?
Well, upon my soul, woman, move it did. What devil's work is this, or have we made a discovery? The tin plate, steel scalpel. Wife, I have it. I've discovered the primary source of life, animal electricity. Animal electricity, that's what it is. I cannot wait. I must go at once to the university. Oh, what a discovery I've made. What a miracle.
Aloisio Galvani rushed post-haste to the university to spread the news of his remarkable discovery, concealing the fact that it was his wife's discovery anyway. There he commenced a series of experiments designed to throw more light on the nature of this newly discovered phenomenon. Soon it became known as galvanism, and scientists gathered from all over Italy to hear Signor Galvani tell his tale of the twitching frog's leg and the deduction he had so cleverly drawn from it. Among these was a professor of physics from the University of Pavia, Alessandro Volta, a man of great intelligence and resource. He was intrigued by Galvani's discovery, and at the first opportunity went to his house at Bologna to hear at first hand exactly what had happened.
Your name, sir? I did not catch your name.
Alessandro Volta, signor, at your service.
Volta? Volta? No, I cannot say I've heard the name. However, pray come in. I may be able to spare you a few moments.
Oh, you are too kind, signor. And I shall take as little of your time as possible.
You are a scientist?
Well, yes. Though, of course, not of your eminence. I am from the University of Pavia, where I lecture in physics.
Ah, yes, of course, Pavia. We have surpassed you here in Bologna these last few months, eh, Volta? Eh?
Oh, undoubtedly. We have not men of your caliber, nor men of your great... well, shall we say, intuition. I am referring to your discovery of animal electricity.
We are using the expression galvanism at the present, in a manner of speaking. A compliment to me.
I beg your pardon. Galvanism, by all means. Now, senor, I am here to learn. What can you tell me about it?
You must be behind the times at Pavia. Further behind than I thought. It is quite obvious that I discovered the prime source of life, the force that distinguishes living creatures from the dust.
Quite so. But how did you come to this conclusion?
Oh, I saw the truth at once, the moment the frog's leg moved.
Upon what? Upon what was the frog's leg resting?
Oh, what does it matter? That has nothing to do with it.
Oh, quite so, quite so. Merely idle curiosity. Pray go on.
Oh, very well, very well. The frog's leg twitched, and I said to myself, a Lucille Galvani, under what compulsion does that dead creature move? You know the answer, Signor Volta?
Yes. Animal electricity.
Oh, really, Professor Volta? Galvanism!
Oh, 1,000 pardons. So that is the story. You saw the frog's leg move. You know it was dead, so you saw the answer immediately.
That is so, Signor.
And knowing that in all human experience, dead creatures did not move.
I am the discoverer of the life force.
Well, that is extremely interesting. Now I must not presume further on your kindness. But before I go, what was the frog resting on? A table? Upon pottery? Earthenware?
It was resting on a tin plate.
Ah, a tin plate. And did anything else touch it? A hand? Perhaps a knife? A fork?
My wife was skinning its leg with a steel scalpel. And now I must ask you to excuse me, Signor. I'm very, very busy these days, and I hope my work will help you here in Pavia.
Your work won't help, my friend. But maybe the discovery you stumbled on will.
Back in Pavia, Alessandro Volta set out on his own account to find why a frog's muscles should twitch as they had done for Galvani. Although he was convinced that Galvani was both stupid and vain to jump at so ridiculous an explanation without a moment's thought. Volta duplicated the conditions in Signora Galvani's kitchen with the tin plate, the steel scalpel, the frog's flayed thigh, and exactly the same twitchings took place. But Volta then went a step further with a bold theory. He reasoned that the frog played a very minor part in the phenomenon, and that some other agency was at work. But his friend Giuseppe was becoming impatient and did not hesitate to say so.
My good friend, how much longer are you going to potter and stoop over this problem? I am beginning to think that Del Galvani was a fraud, that the frogs were alive all the time.
Ah, no, Giuseppe. We cannot believe that. We have demonstrated too often and before too many witnesses.
Then if the frogs were not bewitched and Galvani is wrong, what is the truth about it?
I think I know. But first, I must test my theory. Now, Giuseppe, you have seen the frogs jump when the scalpel touches them.
Yes.
And you think it is from some force coming from the dead frogs.
Of course, that is obvious.
Well, I do not agree. I think this, that whenever moisture comes between two different metals, an electric potential is produced, and the frog therefore merely acted as a conductor between the metal plate and the metal scalpel. If I am right, Giuseppe, imagine what would happen if you connected together hundreds of metal plates with hundreds of frogs and hundreds of scalpels.
I can imagine, with hundreds of frogs in the room.
If I am right, if my theory is right, we would have an electric storehouse that we could tap at will. Now I am going to start experimenting at once, using every combination of every metal known. And you can help.
I can? How?
Out you go. And don't come back until you have a bucket containing 100 frogs.
Volta's experiments have gone down in history. And he has given his name to the unit of electromotive force, the Volt. But before the story is ended, there was still another encounter with Galvani.
Ah, Signor Volta. I have traveled all the way from Bologna to pick a bone with you.
Oh, indeed. Well, first come in and sit down.
Yes.
Now then, what have I done to offend you?
You have stolen my discovery. I have heard about you and your experiments.
Good. Then I need not tell you the results of them.
On the contrary, I insist on hearing, so that I may take proper steps to have you dealt with.
As you please. Now, first of all, I have proved your animal electricity story quite wrong.
Prove me wrong? Prove me wrong, you say?
Yes. The frog's legs had almost nothing to do with the force you found. It was caused by moisture between two different metals.
Ha! Nonsense. It's a farrago of nonsense.
Then examine at your leisure this contrivance I have built. It is the first source of electric current the world has seen. And in deference to you, I have named it the galvanic element.
That is only just.
But that is not what my friends insist on calling it.
Indeed?
No. Some of them have named it the voltaic pile in my honor, while others, and I prefer this name, have called it the electric battery.
From the lucky accident in Signora Galvani's kitchen came the electric battery, or voltaic pile. For many years, the only source of electric current known to man, and still in use today in 1,001 different ways. For Walter, it was but a single step from his discovery of the true nature of Galvani's force to its utilization, making the battery, with which electrical engineering began its conquest of the world. As for Galvani, he was still proclaiming his opinion when he died in 1798 that he had found the life force. So his name has come down to us even though he did not deserve his fame. But Volta's electric battery came about by a matter of luck. Volta had never dreamed of a battery and did not know the principle upon which one could work until Galvani's wife touched the leg of a dead frog lying on a tin plate and made it jump. Surely no matter of intent, just a matter of luck.
The two authentic stories of the discovery of the phonograph and the electric battery were dramatized by Lindsay Hardy from Factual Research Material and were directed by Donovan Joyce. The performers included Richard Ashley, Douglas Herold, Alan Trevor, Reginald Collins, Norman Blackler, Billy Lockwood, David McGoffin, and David Lowe. Your narrator was Ward Leopold, who invites you to listen again 1 week from now, same night, time, and station, for a further fascinating half hour of A Matter of Luck. A Donovan Joyce production.